Hello, I'm Mark Steiner.
And I'm Anthony McCarthy.
And we welcome you all here on A Way to Our Conversation. Let me remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you. More information at www.mecu.com. Or you can jump onto steinershow.org and click on their banner. The information is always there. Anthony and I are here with Wesley Lowery, who's a general assignment political reporter for the Boston Globe, for an update from Boston. And Wesley, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Of course. It's great to be with you. I appreciate it.
So I'm very curious about some of the things I've been reading in the Globe, but I'm also just like to start with what your sense of the tenor of Boston now in the wake of this. Go ahead.
Well, of course, you know, what I was going to say is that today has certainly been a day of mourning and recovery. You know, we had the statewide moment of silence at 2:50 when the first bomb went off, and that was observed across the city, across the state. You know, this is the day we had a wake for one of the three victims. We still have dozens hospitalized. And so it's certainly a feeling and a tenor of mourning, of remembering those who were hurt, of burying our dead. But in the same way, it also is a beginning of a return to normalcy. You know, Boston is a resilient city full of resilient people. We've got, you know, the Red Sox have been playing, the Bruins have been playing. We've got a senatorial debate scheduled for tonight. You know, Boston is showing that it's stronger than the terrorist who kind of horrified all of us last week and has really started to move on.
This is Anthony McCarthy. Wesley, what sense are you getting, and this is kind of a rhetorical question, that with the unfolding conversations taking place with the suspect that's in the hospital, pieces are just kind of coming out of the conversations. He's writing notes. Obviously, charges were handed down today. The people of Boston paying very close attention as this unfolds.
You know, I think yes and no. I think sometimes it's hard to mix what the national attention is and what the people, the day-to-day people in Boston are concerned about. And then I'll be honest, first and foremost, the people here in the city of Boston are concerned about the wounded and the recovery as a city. You know, I think that there's certainly a curiosity. This is a remarkably academic town, a remarkably intelligent town, a very smart town that wants to know what happened and wants to understand. But with that said, the more important thing for most people here in Boston is looking out for the fellow Bostonian. There's less about the little intricacies and the tiny little details that are coming out that for everyone who is not in Boston, it's the biggest new development. It's a little TikTok of it. People here who are living it's less of a priority.
One of the things that I've noticed that in the Globe today that I'd like to cover with you is this, it was a story about the brothers themselves maybe having been involved in a previous killing. That you're investigating that.
We're looking into that. One of the older brother, people who were allegedly some of his best friends were killed on September 11th, 2011. Unsolved murder still has yet to be solved. There's been some speculation about that. I'll be honest, I'm not one of the main reporters on that element of the story, so I don't want to comment in too much detail because I don't know all of the details. But with that said, there is this unsolved murder that today remains unsolved. And now I've seen some friends of the older brother who have been quoted and have said, this was always strange. And now that we know this guy who we thought was our friend was capable of committing a terrorist attack, maybe he was linked to this. And so that's starting to be relitigated again, starting to figure out, because that also would have been around the time when the older of the two brothers did start to become, according to friends and family members, more radical, more extreme in his views, more angry. And so there certainly seems to potentially be a connection there, but we're still digging back into it, and I'm sure police investigators are digging back into that as well.
So is there an indication as whether the Boston itself, the state's attorney in Boston, is going to prosecute him as well as being prosecuted by the feds?
Yes, there will be further charges. So, for example, if you look at the federal charges, there's no mention of the MIT police officer who was murdered.
Correct.
Because those charges will come at the state level. The federal charge is possession and use of a weapon of mass destruction. That is a federal charge for the acts of terrorism. There will be upcoming state charges for many other things. We have an officer who was wounded and is still hospitalized. We have an officer who was murdered. So there will be other charges coming at the state level and potentially even more at the federal level. What we have right now is just the federal charges. So there will be more coming. We know that.
Well, Wesley Lowery, I appreciate you taking the time out of your busy day. General assignment, political reporter for the Boston Globe. And enjoyed our conversation. Look forward to talking to you again soon.
Of course, anytime. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Wes.
It was Wesley Lowery from the Boston Globe to get an update on what's happening in Boston from that perspective. We are now joined by Akbar Ahmed, who is the Ibn Khaldun Chair of Islamic Studies at American University, senior fellow at the Brookings Institute, and he's a former Pakistani ambassador to the United Kingdom and Ireland, and Joyce Davis, author of Between Jihad and Islam, Profiles in Islam, and president of the World Affairs Council of Harrisburg. Akbar Ahmed and Joyce Davis, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You.
It's such a pleasure to be on with my friend Joyce.
Thank you.
Well, we have to thank our friend Joyce for introducing us to you, so all that's good.
That's right.
And our friend.
Well, a bit of nepotism there.
it began even deeper with one of my colleagues, Suni Khalid, who introduced me to Joyce, so it all comes around. But I was very interested, you know, when we first talked, Joyce, last week, and you suggested we call the ambassador to join us as well, that one of the things you said was that you thought this had less to do with Chechnya and more to do with drones.
Well, when you called me, I was like many people looking at this, trying to ask why. What's going on? What's the connection? I happen to have worked with Chechens. I was also associate director of broadcasting for Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. One of the services that we had was a radio service into Chechnya, into the North Caucasus. And I did not know of any real, the animosity that they sense, and it's a great deal of hatred and anger, is toward Russia. So I was just trying to figure out, and I happened to be reading the book, a new book that Dr. Akbar has out, that talks about, and it's entitled The Thistle and the Drone. And it talks about, how we may be sowing the seeds for a new generation of terrorists. And so I just was musing, could it be that he has something else on his mind, that he was angry about something else? Could it have to do with what we know going on now with the drone attack? So it was just my musings about what could possibly be behind this.
And Ambassador, what about that? I think that I'm looking forward to reading The Thistle and the Drone and to having you back on to talk about your book. I'm curious what you think.
I think Joyce has put a finger on something important, because the whole notion of tribal societies provoked or agitated or stirred into violence, into trauma by the use of the drone. The drone is not only something substantial, a harbinger of death, delivering mayhem in those communities, but also very symbolic of something that tribesmen have no way of dealing with. But the study that you're quoting, The Thistle and the Drone, has 40 tribal societies stretching from Morocco right across the Middle East and into Central Asia. And the drone is used specifically for 5 or 6 tribal societies. And there's a very interesting correlation if you look at the tribal societies of East Afghanistan, in the tribal areas of Pakistan, then in the Yemen, in Somali, among the Kurds in eastern Turkey. There's talk of the drone being used by the French against the Tuareg tribes in Mali. And what the drone is doing, and we've studied this in great detail, the drone actually is the sort of last nail in the coffin in a society that has been completely disintegrated. For one day you have the central government army, helicopters, missiles, artillery. Next day you have these suicide bombers from within the community blowing up people. The next day you may have tribal rivalry. And then you have the drone, as it were, the final straw. And there's very little left in the community than that cohesion, that stability is gone. And from that is coming directly this very violent reaction of the young men. There's a clear correlation in Pakistan. The TTP, the Tehrik-e-Taliban in Pakistan, which is the most deadly variety of the Taliban, they start life, they organize straight after the drones begin in Waziristan. 2004, the drones start. 2007, they have formed and they become now a deadly force, in some cases paralyzing Pakistan. So the Chechen example is slightly different because the Chechen example is rooted in the history of relations between Moscow and the Chechens. And again, I cover that as one of the case studies. And that is a terrible and a heartbreaking and a sad story because it's really been like one steady genocide. So by the late 1990s, something like 10% of the entire population was just wiped out, decimated. Decades earlier, if you recall, Stalin had done something similar with the Chechen. He had just simply picked up and uprooted 20 or 30% of the entire population. And these boys are coming out of that.
Yeah, what I was simply trying to raise is that we know that it's brutal what Russia has done to Chechnya, but the United States has never really been a part of that. In fact, it's opposed it.
Exactly.
We do know that the reaction from the Chechens has really been among the most militant. I mean, we remember Beslan and moving into taking over schools.
Exactly.
So it has been a violent reaction, but the U.S. was never involved in it.
It wasn't. And, you know, Joyce, this is something that can be explained within the frame, the theoretical frame, which I've explored, again, because I've got several case studies exactly the same. Because, you see, we are, Joyce, trying to rationalize. We are saying, well, why should these guys be attacking schools, children, in some cases mosques, in some cases opera houses, as in Moscow, the airport, the metro, and so on. And we are rationalizing it. In fact, their actions are very specifically designed to simply cause pain and hurt. Mm-hmm. And we have many quotations from all of these groups, whether it's these guys, the Chechen in Russia, whether it's the TTP in Pakistan, the Boko Haram in the west of Africa, the Al-Shabaab in Somalia, where they say this. They say, our aim is to show you what we have experienced and are experiencing. So it is a very bitter struggle. And you're absolutely right that the United States has nothing to do with Chechnya, and therefore we should be looking for clues as to why they did what they did, these two men, not in any rational frame that they're attacking the United States to make a political point, because there is no political point in attacking an iconic event in Boston. There's no geopolitical reason that they should be doing so.
Well,
yet, if we... Yes.
There may not be a political point, but just to throw in here, one of the in conversations I've had over the years with people that the West might consider terrorists, there was a theme there, and part of the theme was that the people in the West have no understanding of the pain our
Correct.
People go through.
Correct.
And we can show that same pain in return.
Yeah, I was just going to say that is a very good point because, and one of the things that Dr. Akbar makes clear in his books and from my interviews with militants too is that they want the U.S. attention. They believe the U.S. could do something and isn't doing something. And if they were also, if Americans were also made to suffer, maybe they would rise up and do something. I mean, isn't that correct, Dr. Akbar?
Yes, Joyce, you're absolutely right because, you know, again, in the examples that we dug into, in many cases, these people on the periphery actually look up to and admire and even have a lot of affection for the United States, whether it's the Somali, whether it's the Chechen, whether it's the Pukhtun. And they, exactly as you say, they hope that their suffering will be mitigated if the United States intervenes and stops the killing, because the central government in some of these cases has been absolutely brutal. Now, it doesn't happen for all kinds of reasons, and therefore that admiration or that love turns into hate. And, you know, the line between love and hate is always a very thin one. So there's that element, but even more so, my own feeling is that these people are not normal anymore. They are broken people. They're physically broken. They're mentally broken. They've been through the most traumatic experiences, mothers raped, gang raped, fathers sodomized, everything in front of them. And they are really there just to simply cause pain when they could get the opportunity, as you saw in Beslan and these other instances in Russia and now in Boston.
So, go ahead, Anthony.
So, Ms. Davis, I just wanted to ask you a very quick question, and certainly, Ambassador, you can chime in as well. But I noticed almost immediately when I got an alert on my phone on Monday, and certainly as part of this station. We've been following and getting updates. But I noticed on social media something that actually did not shock me, but disturbed me at the level it went. The anti-Islamic rhetoric. Before we even knew anything, suspects, you know, who was responsible, who was claiming responsibility, people really leaped on Islam and radical Islam. And does that surprise you?
You know, it doesn't surprise me. It is most unfortunate. You know, I do a lot of speaking around the country, and I speak to and I am still somewhat taken aback sometimes at the level of ignorance that still exists with regard to Islam and the Islamic world.
Mm-hmm.
I have people asking all kinds of questions, including why haven't we heard any Muslim clerics speak out against terrorism, which, of course, is ridiculous. They're speaking out all over the world against terrorism. It, unfortunately, despite the access that is available now to information about other peoples, other cultures, other religion, we find Americans are still woefully ignorant of exactly what Islam, one of the world's major religions, is. And so, no, it doesn't surprise me that the fears that they have automatically go to prejudice and automatically go to hatred.
And I think Joyce has put it very well, because after years and years of really very hard work of people like Joyce in the media trying to create a mutual understanding, build bridges, I was a bit disappointed that we almost, and luckily it didn't happen fully, but we were almost down that road again where a kind of Islamophobia began to develop in the media, and we began to hear that must be Muslims, and then very quickly it was all Muslims,
right.
And now we have prominent political figures in the United States actually saying things like this. Now, that is dangerous, because from one incident, you again begin to brush with a very paint an entire community with a very broad brush, and the result is that you have these a backlash developing, and you know, stories coming in of a Sikh or a Hindu or a Bengali who are not Muslims also being attacked or pushed around or abused. And that's something I think we have to be very, very careful about, because it's a slippery slope.
And I wonder I know one of the things people are going to be looking at in this particular case is the trip home these two brothers made to Dagestan. It has to bring to mind the question of what happens to what is happening with younger secular Islamic Muslim men and boys who embrace a more fundamentalist view of the world in Islam itself.
Well, the first thing you have to also keep in mind is that one thing Americans don't realize is the level of suffering that exists around the world.
Right, right.
And how intense that is. And so you take someone that who has perhaps been shielded from that and plop them down, and suddenly they're in the middle of all of that, and they realize the horror of it, and it's their own people. And if they're young and impressionable, you know, in the teen years, you know, they may indeed come back and be impacted by that. That's not to say that everybody will experience that and come back and become a terrorist, but you can understand how vulnerable they might be if they are suddenly exposed to what is absolute misery in many parts of the world.
And one of the things I was struck by, Ambassador, is that when this happened in Boston, and it didn't get a lot of play in the press, but I was watching very carefully on the internet, on the web, that from Syria and from Iraq, the same messages came. There were pictures of Iraqis and Syrians saying, "We live through this every day. Our hearts and sympathies go out to the people in Boston." That's something we don't talk about. That
yes, and also that we assume that it's a straightforward West versus East clash, but in fact, the Muslim leadership here in the United States is also, in a sense, to take some of the blame, because the imams, for example, or the political and social leaders, they should really be much, much more active and much more aware of their own community. They should be watching signs of this kind of behavior in the young, and again, watching out. Someone's been back to Dagestan a couple of months, comes back. I mean, surely someone would have picked this up in the mosque or in the neighborhood and said, "What's going on?" And try to push these youngsters more towards constructive projects, development projects, projects where their energy, their angst is then channeled into something constructive, rather than let them be on their to their own devices, and then allow them to go down this path, which in the end could be so destructive for them and the community.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, you see this divide. Also, I think with things to explore a little bit in a few minutes we have left in a longer show soon. Is the divide that exists inside the Islamic world? I mean, in your own country, Ambassador, who you represented for many years, is the kind of this kind of fundamentalist view out of some of the more of the groups that we would call terrorists who are out there coming out of Waziristan, and another large core of Pakistanis who are Muslim, of every different stripe, who are more secular in some ways and view the world in a different way. I mean, that there's an internal struggle going on.
There's a very severe, and this is, again, a very relevant question you raise, because people ask me, well, all right, you know, you're fine, but where are the moderates? Where are the other moderates? And I tell them that I am just like, I would say, 90% of the Muslim world battling for a modern kind of vision of society. And today you do have, there's no doubt about it, you have what was once seen as marginal, these groups who today are threatening to upset the order, committing violence, doing all kinds of terrible things, becoming suicide bombers. They are now in some districts in Pakistan setting the agenda. Their law and order has actually collapsed in parts of the Punjab, parts of Balochistan, parts of the frontier province. And that is an internal struggle that we are not aware of. For example, my wife comes from Swat. It's a state up in North
right.
Pakistan. Six of her first cousins, very close relatives, have died in battling against the Taliban. They've been there. They belong to the royal family there, and so they didn't want to back down. They took them on. Now, these are my daughters there right now trying to create a college and a school right there with her husband. Again, she did a PhD at Cambridge, went back and said, no, I must dedicate my life to education for women. So people don't really know the stories of these people who are out there in the front ranks and not prepared to back down and say, well, all right, let these Taliban take over and play havoc with our societies. That battle is on, and I think if America is aware of that, it will not only feel more encouraged, but then be more aware of where to actually push and support, because that support is crucial for people who are battling in countries like Pakistan, which it will encourage them and also bring down the levels of anti-Americanism, which right now are fairly high in these countries.
And
we have to take a break. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I want to back what he says, because I sometimes talk about the war within Islam, and I think Americans need to know that so many Muslims are putting their own lives on the line to battle extremism.
I want to thank you both, and we'll look forward to having you both on. You just heard Dr. Joyce Davis, who's author of Jihad and Salam, Profiles in Islam, President of the World Affairs Council of Harrisburg, and the Ambassador, Dr. Akbar Ahmed, who holds the Ibn Khaldun Chair of Islamic Studies at American University, Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institute, former Pakistani Ambassador to the United Kingdom and Ireland, and the author of the book The Thistle and the Drone, which we will have him back on very soon to talk about in great depth. And so, Ambassador and Joyce Davis, thank you so much for being with
thank
us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Goodbye.
We're going to take a very brief break. We're going to come back. We're going to take one caller, Marie. We'll hear what you have to say. And we'll be then talking to Darren Samuelson, Robert Call, and Jeffrey Simon from Britain to talk about the issues facing questions of terrorism, what they really mean, the lockdown, what did that really mean, and is America facing a new kind of crackdown? And we'll talk about all that coming up in the next half an hour. Stay with us. We'll be right back as we explore Boston's aftermath in depth.